thanks, Ivers, and thanks for inviting me. I should thank the NSA for funding this. I was told they do attend these meetings, but we don't know who they are. So I'm going to talk about prime numbers, progress, and pitfalls. I guess we've heard there's been a lot of progress just in the last year and a half, but there's still a lot of stuff still to do. In fact, the progress isn't maybe as great as maybe it's been advertised, although it's still shockingly impressive. So before, I'm going to do math some, but I thought I would talk a little bit about just why prime numbers are popular and why people study them for a while. So the question is, why are prime numbers popular with the public? And I tried to come up with some reasons this morning when I was writing my talk. Well, they're easy to define, everyone understands them, they're familiar, they're not threatening, they tend to not scare people away like sheafs of germs of C-star algebras or whatever they are. And they have a huge advantage nowadays because with your computer you can easily do experiments on prime numbers and find their properties, and you can do it in ranges where no one else has bothered to look yet. So basically they're easy to experiment and play around with now. And of course, there's old famous unsolved problems concerning primes, including, the twin prime conjecture, most people refer to that one. The Goldbach conjecture, most people refer to that one. And there's also the Riemann hypothesis, which actually is a conjecture about prime numbers, or equivalent to one, and it even includes a $1 million reward. I think there was $1 million on the Goldbach conjecture, but that was actually just an insurance policy that some publishing company bought, and it's expired. So, anyhow, but why would you study? So that's why people might be interested in it. But why would you want to study prime numbers? And I sort of broke it up into different groups of people. So first, there's mathematicians, and I think the main interest isn't that primes are necessarily so interesting just in themselves, but it's because they really create difficult problems. Extremely hard problems, but there's problems where you have amazing proofs. If you actually try to read these proofs, you almost can't believe that you can prove these things. And of course, it's a field that just can't be killed off, because every problem, even if you solve the problem, you can refine the problem. And there's not really that much progress over a short period of time, except occasionally. There's also a lot of interesting history. It goes back to the Greeks. There's a lot of literature if you're interested in studying what other people did. Amateurs tend not to be interested in those aspects. There's interesting personalities involved. There's applications to many areas, but I don't know much about those. But apparently there is a lot of applications of primes of the techniques to other areas. And of course, by studying primes, you will achieve humility. Or actually not. Most of the mathematicians I know study primes aren't particularly good on humility. But they get to experience lots of humiliation. And of course you can get a job too. Usually not studying primes, but you get to study primes while you teach calculus or business calculus. Now, unfortunately, since I sort of became well-known about 10 years ago, I've been in contact with a lot of amateurs of a certain type. And, I mean, I literally get emails from them all the time. I've put them in spam, a lot of them, but I basically, at least once a week, I'm in contact with some amateur who's proved the twin prime conjecture. So there is a type of amateur who tries to prove the twin prime conjecture, and the question is, why do they study primes? And there's a typical progression that's almost always true, which is they're really interested in fame. And usually they don't achieve fame. In fact, they probably never achieve fame, although there might be a few exceptions, but if you really look at the exceptions, they're not really exceptions. Usually the amateur who's interested in fame, they do find some patterns in the twin primes or in the primes that are interesting, sometimes unexpected, but they don't help you prove anything. And then they end up, after making that, they waste their time continually trying to argue that they've discovered something, and then they waste other people's time. And then they end up learning nothing and end up being crackpots. So, I mean, I'm not trying to insult them, but I'm not the one who's sending out emails all the time to other people trying to get them to believe me. Anyhow, so that's the one type of amateur. Now, there is another type of amateur. I'm not denigrating them. I mean, an amateur is someone who isn't getting paid for doing it, pretty much. There's other amateurs who really do like to study primes just because they like working on them or working on areas related to them, and they actually can be pretty helpful. They can usually find useful ideas. They can do a lot of computations. In fact, some of the work on the Polymath project is by a guy who specializes in admissible sets. He's just a computer. He's a computer guy, and he's just set up a website. He's been working on this thing for 20 years. They make up questions. Sometimes their questions are sort of stupid, but they're actually become sort of interesting to other mathematicians. So just by asking questions or making conjectures, they sometimes create interesting problems to look at. But the downside, if you're not in the field, is that it is hard to publish this stuff. And unfortunately, I get some of these papers, and you sort of have to explain to them that, you know, it's hard to publish things where you don't have any proofs or any theorems, even if it is sort of interesting. Okay, well, now the question comes up, why do primes make fools out of all of us, mathematicians or amateurs? And they really do, you know, they can really trick you. I've personally been tricked quite a bit. There's a lot of reasons. The first one is sometimes there's properties like the twin prime conjecture which are just obviously true, and you can't help but be convinced of it instantly when you start looking at the data. But seeing it that it's true, and not just a little bit true, but easily true, doesn't actually give you any clue how to prove them. So, on the other hand, there's questions about primes where you just can't figure it out no matter what you do. So there's an example of this. There's a problem not for twin primes, but for large gaps between primes. So Pn plus 1 minus Pn is the gap between the f and the n plus first prime. And the question is, how big can that gap get? Now, theoretically, we can't even prove, assuming the Riemann hypothesis, that the gap is smaller than the square root of log Pn, which you'll never see anything that large. But the conjecture is, due to Cremer, is that it never gets bigger than log squared of Pn. And it's just hard to find examples of that. It's like trying to sift through enormous sets of numbers, and you just never can find these really rare occurrences where you just have a large distance between primes. So that's an example where you just don't know the answer. In fact, lately, the latest conjecture, I don't know if I believe it, is you should get a little constant in front of log squared, like something like 1.12 or something. But we have no evidence for that. And another reason we always get fooled by primes is that sometimes what sounds like an unbelievably hard problem actually isn't quite so hard. So here's an example. Can you find 1,000 consecutive primes which end with the digits 8765432111111? Now that sounds pretty hard to me. You have to find 1,000 of them consecutive, one after the other, and they have to end with those digits. But in fact, that actually, I'm not saying it's easy to prove, but it was basically fairly standard in the field stuff. It was proved by Daniel Hsu in 2000. It's called the congruent prime problem. They have to basically be, you can find consecutive primes in arithmetic progressions. And the funny thing is, I actually refereed the paper But I didn't actually, and it just seemed fairly routine. I didn't realize it had this application. So when I heard it, I thought, what? This can't be done. And then it turned out I had actually refereed the paper. Now, of course, if the difference between the mathematician and maybe the public is that a mathematician realizes that if you replace 1,000 consecutive primes by 3, if you replace all those digits I wrote there by just the digit 1, it's probably not any different, you see. So we make the problem look worse, but it really, if you can just get a prime in a single consecutive primes in a single arithmetic progression, then you should be able to do it for any arithmetic progression. Okay. Then there's things where calculations just can't help you, and theoretical work can't help you, but you can still guess the right answer, but you're just unable to verify it or prove it in any way. And I'm going to show you a little example. It's called the jumping champion problem. Okay, so that's that. Now I'm going to try to come back and show you how primes often don't hide their true nature, so you can easily figure out what's going on. So here's the primes up to 100. There's 25, so if you want to take something away from the talk, a quarter of the numbers less than or equal to 100 are prime. And here's the first 10 primes starting at a billion. So you see the pattern there? No, I don't either, actually. You'll notice that there is a twin prime. The first two primes larger than a billion are twin primes. They differ by 2. But the thing about this is, when you actually look at, no matter where you look, even in like 100-digit numbers on Mathematica or 200-digit, you still keep finding primes, and that's because you never run out of primes. And the reason you never run out of primes is that if you pick different primes here and multiply them together and add 1, you get a number, and that number isn't divisible by any of the primes. So take this number, divide by P1, you get this guy plus 1 over P1, which isn't an integer. So I just slipped in here a proof, you see. I just showed you that if you have any list of primes, it can't be, you can generate primes that aren't in the list. So therefore, there's infinitely many primes. So a lot of the cranks I deal with really wouldn't believe this. I mean, they think that you can just prove it by doing more of this, but anyhow. A few of them will actually generalize this to prove it for twin primes, but that has never worked for anybody. Well, now let's look at the number of primes. So primes basically are fairly random. There isn't any obvious pattern in them. But what if you count the number of primes up to x? We call that pi of x. So here I've graphed the number of primes up to x, and you can see here that there's none, and then we get to 2. Now there's a prime, 2. And then when x is 3, you now have got a second prime, 3, and so on. So you get this function that's counting the primes. And what I told you was right. This one here should just be at 25. But okay, so that's the counting function. That's the counting function for primes. And here it is if you look at it between 0 and 1,000. So you can see it's a little rough. There's some irregularity. And here it is between 0 and 1,000,000. So you can see there's nothing random about primes at all. They clearly have an average density. They're just being added on in a perfectly regular fashion. And that's called the prime number theorem. So what we say is that the primes less than or equal to x are asymptotic to x over log of x, or that limit. And here's a picture. So the bottom one is x over log of x, and this is the number of primes. So you can immediately see, I mean, the prime number theorem is simply saying that the ratio of these two values is going to 1, or in other words, the ratio of the difference between the two divided by the total size is going to 0. But you can see that's a pretty lousy fit, right? It's not really doing a good job, even though it's giving you maybe a fairly approximate first approximation. So we have a better approximation for primes, which is that it's called the Kermeer model. It says the probability of a number is prime is just 1 over log of n. And by the way, I guess This is the natural log. So so prime numbers know about B. Of course, the reason they know about E is because the harmonic series also knows about E. So integers know about E too. So if you have this Cramer model, you just assume the probability that a number is prime is 1 over n. So therefore, the number of primes you should get is just the, you can think of it as probability or density, which should be the sum of the probabilities that each of the numbers up to x is prime. And that's approximately, the sum is essentially the same as the integral. And this is called the logarithmic integral. And that would be a better approximation. Think about it. Why should n doesn't really know about x. You really should look at the chance that n is a prime, not in terms of x, but just in itself. Anyhow, so here's the picture. This is the number of primes between a million and a million 100,000, and one of them's the primes and one of them's the logarithmic integral. So you can see it's pretty good. Does anyone know which is which? I didn't label it. Which is the top one? It's the logarithmic integral. So if you look at this, you see this fit is really amazingly good. In fact, these are numbers out at a million. If you look at the width of the difference, it's about 1,000 on that scale. It's about the square root. And that's basically equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis. So it's an amazingly good fit for this random phenomenon. Now, some people claim that, you see, well, there's sort of a story associated with this. The logarithmic integral, people claim that Riemann conjectured that the logarithmic integral is larger, always larger than the number of primes. And this is evidence that you really shouldn't use numerical data to make your conjectures. But if you actually look at it, Riemann never actually made that conjecture, number one. And number two, I don't think if you saw this picture, you would necessarily believe that the lower guy's never going to get bigger than the upper guy. They're very close together. Well, in any case, it turned out that Littlewood proved in 1914 that, in fact, they'll oscillate. So sometimes the number of primes will be bigger than the logarithmic integral. Riemann actually found an approximation for pi of x where the logarithmic integral is the first term, and then there's a correcting second term in terms of the logarithmic integral for the squares of the primes. So the logarithmic integral does have an initial advantage, but that dissipates to some extent. Although the first exception to this that's known is at about 10 to the 300th, the 340 digit size number, and it has never been computed. It's simply, you know, there's a range of like 10 to the 100th numbers in a row where the pi of x is bigger than y of x. Well, now, that was primes. What I didn't tell you is that they conjectured the prime number theorem Gauss conjectured in 1790, and the proof was quickly achieved in 1896 independently by Hadamard and Baillot-Alpesson. So it took about 100 years to come up with a proof from the time people conjectured this theorem. So these things take a while. But now we come to the twin primes. Here they are. I've just listed them. They're primes differing by 2. You can look at them up at a billion too, and here the twin primes up to a billion, they're a little thinner. Now I'm going to count the number of twin primes just like I counted the number of primes, but I count a pair of them as only one twin prime pair. So you see right here is 3. So 3 and 5 is the first twin prime pair, and then 5 and 7 is the second one. 11 and 13 is the third. So that's twin primes. You can see they're more irregular. They're more irregular than primes because there's fewer of them. And you can also see that this is a step function, but Mathematica wanted a picture that looks nice, so I'm not quite sure. Those are some sort of artifact. Here it is up to 100,000. So by the time you get up to 100,000, it's smoothing out. And here's the picture up to a million. I lost the labels on there. That's actually two pictures. One of them is the number of twin primes up to a million, And the second one is this logarithmic integral of 1 over log of t squared times this constant, 1.3203. And you can see we have a very similar type of fit, just like before. So we basically will conjecture a prime number theorem for twin primes just as easily as for primes. It's clear there's infinitely many twin primes. It's clear they have an average density. And you can check this in ranges for numbers as large as you want, in shorter intervals. You'll keep seeing exactly the same relation. You'll even see a square root of x error term. So you could have sort of a Riemann hypothesis for this type of thing too, although the real Riemann hypothesis doesn't have anything to say about it. But what about that 1.3203? I just gave it to you. And it turns out you can actually explain that as well, at least heuristically, in several ways. And the idea is you could ask the question, what's the probability that n and n plus 2 are both prime? And the Cremer model says that the chance that n is prime is 1 over log n, n plus 2 is prime, 1 over log n again, essentially. If they're independent, it's the product. So it makes sense to conjecture that the density is 1 over log of x squared, or the integral of it. But what about the constant? And it turns out that that's a case where this Cremer model is a little bit wrong, because it doesn't take into account divisibility, you see. So if you think about it, I mean, even the Cremer model at the beginning, the chance that an even number is prime is not 1 over log of the even number. It's 0, because it's not a prime. And in this case, if you have a prime bigger than 2, the chance that p plus 1 is prime is 0, because it's an even number. And furthermore, if you look at if you have a prime, then p plus 2 is necessarily an odd number, which doubles the chance that it's a prime, you see, because you know it's not even. So therefore, you have to now look at when n and n plus 2 are not divisible by all the primes in order to correct. So if you pick two numbers at random, the chance that they're both odd is a quarter, because it's a half for the first one, half for the second, just two random numbers. They're independent. So the chance that two numbers you pick are both odd is a quarter, but the chance that n and n plus 2 are both odd is actually a half, because if n is odd, then so is n plus 2, and the other half of the time n is even, but then so is this. So half the time, they're both odd. So in fact, for even and oddness, you actually get n and n plus 2 both odd twice as frequently as random. And maybe I won't go through all this. If you ask whether you're divisible by 3, randomly 4/9 of the numbers are not divisible by 3. Two numbers are not divisible by 3 randomly 4/9 of the time. But if you think of n and n plus 2, it's actually a little worse chance, because if n is divisible by 3, then they're not both divisible. And n plus 2 is divisible by 3, they're not. The only way to not be divisible by 3 for both of them is if n leaves a remainder of 1 mod 3. Then this one, I'm sorry, if it's 2 mod 3, and then this one would be 4 mod 3. So that's only a third of the time. Anyhow, so the net effect here is that randomly the primes will be, two numbers will not be divisible by a prime, 1 minus 1 over 2 squared, but on the other hand, the chance that n and n plus 2 are not divisible by 2 is a little bit smaller. It's 1 minus the 2 residue classes mod p that you have to avoid n and n plus 2 being in. So when you put those corrections in, the random, you divide by the random and then put in the true one, you get this kind of factor for correction for divisibility in the Cremer model. And then you put it together over all the primes, and you come up with this conjecture. And this number is that 1.32, whatever. It's actually obtained earlier by Hardy and Littlewood by a different method. So I have to now tell you the Hardy-Littlewood conjecture. You don't have to take it too, you don't have to absorb it all in one go. But basically, twin primes are when you have n and n plus 2, but you could look at a whole bunch of k numbers, and you could ask, when are all these numbers going to be prime? And so you can shift them all by certain shifts, h1 through hk, And what Hardy Littlewood conjectured in 1923 is that you have a similar as-a-product formula, k numbers, the chance each one is prime is 1 over log, so it's 1 over log to the k. You have a correction for from divisibility, which is a certain singular series, and this is basically a measure of how many of the residue classes have p, the h's fall into this loose of h of p. So that's sort of like the probability that you're going to get a tuple here that avoids all the primes. Divisibility by all the primes, so you can actually get primes in there. So that's the Hardy-Littlewood k-tuple conjecture, and it's a generalization of the twin prime conjecture. And this one's a long way away from being proof, but we've actually got some sort of concrete results now related to this conjecture. Anyhow, so that's what you can just observe, and it's all this stuff is obviously true. Now, some mathematicians will play devil's advocate and say, well, I don't have a proof. I don't know whether it's true or not. And I was thinking about that when I was flying over here on the airplane, and I thought, well, do I have a proof this plane isn't going to crash? And well, I'm still riding in it, but it's much more likely it's going to crash than there aren't any twin primes after a certain point. But I'm still riding in the plane, so I think in real life we would be easily convinced. I mean, I was thinking, I don't know if I bet my life on it, but I'm betting my life on something. I mean, as it turned out, actually two of the planes broke down before we left the gate and getting here, and then they claimed, they said to compensate for the fact that we were really late and we had to shift two airplanes, they said, well, but safety's our number one concern, so you should be happy about that. Yeah, I guess I am. Now, here's another type of problem. This is a problem that came about from amateurs. Well, not amateurs, but by people that weren't number theorists. This is from the Journal of Recreational Math, and I think it's Harry Nelson. He worked it at Lawrence Livermore Lab back in the 70s and 80s, and they would put in these new computers, and his job was, as a programmer, was to debug them all and get them all to work right. And he said that the way you always do that is you give the computer problems that the designers didn't expect, and he always would give it lots of number theory problems and could find all sorts of bugs in it. And so he was one of the editors, I think, for Journal of Recreational Math. And the problem he proposed in 1977 was to find the most probable difference between consecutive primes. And a year later, they didn't actually have a solution for that one. He sort of said that there may not be any most probable. So most probable means that if you look at all the primes up to X and then look at all their differences, which difference is the most common difference of all of those? He sort of said there that there's some evidence that the most common difference between primes is 6, but there seems to be good reason to expect that 30 will eventually win out, and later 2, 10, and 2. They'll all have their day. That's the end. He actually was motivated to this question because somebody in Popular Computing magazine, which I think no longer exists anymore, but it had its day too. They claimed that 6 was the most common distance between primes. Well, it turned out in 1980, Erdős and Strauss proved that if you assumed that Hardy-Littlewood conjecture for prime pairs, not just twins, there would be no most likely difference, because as you went further and further out, the most common difference would get larger and larger. So that was a theoretical result. And then Alvisco started talking about this problem a lot in the early 90s. I remember hearing about it, and since I'm in the field, I thought about it, and I decided it was just a totally stupid problem, because I thought it was too influenced by what happens at the start, you see, the most common, maybe. But that turned out to not actually be true. And Conway called these jumping champions are the most common ones. And I don't want to go through all the stuff. You can count the number of primes up to X whose difference, consecutive difference with the next prime is D. You can now take the maximum over all the different differences. And then the jumping champions are the Ds that where that maximum's achieved. So for example, if X is 100, what's the jumping champion for primes less than or equal to 100? And I did this one for you. There's the primes, there's 25 of them. Here's the differences. So 3 minus 2 is 1, but that never happens again, you see. But those are all the differences. And you can see there's one difference, which is 1. There's 8 times, there's a difference of 2, and 7 times a difference of 4. And yeah, so the jumping champion for 100 is 2, and it actually occurred 8 times there. And here is absolutely everything that's known about jumping champions. Without except, this is the only thing that's known is this table here. Well, you can see a little bit more. 1 is definitely not a jumping champion after 3. So you see, the primes less than or equal to 3, there's only one difference, and it's 1. So it's the champion. But by the time you get to 5, you now have 2 differences, 1 and 2, and they tie. They each occur once. But the thing you should notice here is that there's places where there's ties, like the different differences tie. But starting here at 941 is the last time you have a tie between 4 and 6. So that means that at 947, 6 is going to take over. And then it never quits after that, as far as we know, up to 10 to the 15th. So the most common... All we know about jumping champions is really that as soon as you're bigger than 946, up to at least 10 to 15, 6 is the most common difference. Alvisco, Rubenstein, Wolf studied this, but they did conjecture, in fact, that the jumping champions are always these numbers, 2, 6, 30, 2, 10. You guys see what these numbers are? They're what? That's right. These are what are called primorials. But I'm not sure. You can figure out why. These are, so 6 is 2 times 3, and 30 is 2 times 3 times 5. So these are common in a lot of problems in number theory. So conjecture is all the jumping champions are precisely these champions. And Alvisco and Rubenstein and Wolf conjectured that you actually will switch from 6 to 30 at 1.7427 times 10 to the 35th. But there's absolutely no way to check. It's done heuristically, and I don't even know if I believe. I don't know if I haven't asked them if they still believe this. 30 will transition to 210 at 10 to the 425th, maybe. And the only thing I worked on it with Andrew Lidon, and because they were trying to get such careful answers. They thought it was a really hard problem to prove their conjecture, but it turns out that you can prove their conjecture, at least for sufficiently large primes, for sufficiently large numbers, you can prove that the jumping champions are primorials if you assume that Hardy-Littlewood conjecture I showed you, but for pairs and triples only. So you can't actually address it conjecturally. But the interesting thing about it is that... if you actually want to prove anything about it, you can't prove anything. I mean, nothing has been proven. And I actually spent a lot of time trying to prove that 2 is not a jumping champion, ever. Or at least, it isn't always going to be. For all we know, that 2, which is actually the biggest loser, not the biggest winner. I mean, differences of 2 don't occur as much as the other differences. Try to prove that 2 is not the biggest winner, and I don't know how to do it. Yeah, so that's a case of a problem which you can sort of guess the answer, you can prove a little bit, but you can't numerically do much. Okay, so now we come to the recent progress on bounded gaps between primes. So this is a case where these are pretty shocking results for now, but maybe in 5 years we'll just say, yeah, so what? Yeah, this field, it's funny, this field, you just don't get any respect for too long. After a while, they'll just say, well, I guess no one good was really working in that field. Anyhow, so well, in April of 2013, Yiteng Zhang, who was basically not unknown, but not well-known either, produced a manuscript which which within a couple weeks was verified by two of the big experts in the field. And he proved there were bounded gaps between primes. 70 million was his bound, but he wasn't trying hard. He had actually just done the arithmetic in his own paper. If he hadn't rounded up, he would have had 60 million too, but I think he was trying not to play that game. By August, this PolyMath project, which was an online project which a lot of mathematicians contributed to, it was sort of led by Terry Tao, reduced 70 million to 4,680. In November, James Maynard found a different method for doing this and immediately obtained, for a while he had 700, but he immediately obtained 600 by a different method than Zhang. And Terry Tao sort of independently around the same time discovered this method. And the method that Maynard has actually doesn't just, Zhang's only proves there's two primes close together. It's incapable of finding three primes close together. But Maynard's method gets any number of primes. So you can get 1,000 primes. Infinitely often you'll be able to find 1,000 primes a bounded distance apart. Now the bound's pretty huge. It's quite huge, but it still exists. So. And the number 600 got reduced to 246. So it's been staying at 246 for a while, and they've now published their paper. But probably small improvements will continue here, but not down to the twin prime conjecture. Now, both of these methods are based on the GPY method from 2005. I sort of got beat. I spent a number of years working on this and was humiliated again by later events. But let me tell you about the GPY method. The goal, this is sort of a strange thing. There's barriers to proving pairs of numbers are prime that were discovered by Bombieri in the 70s, related to what's called the asymptotic sieve. And pretty much Bombieri proved that if you just took two types of numbers, like n plus h and n plus h2, you could, in a perfect world where you knew the distribution of primes was good in the arithmetic progressions, you still would never be able to distinguish, if this one was a prime, you could never distinguish if this was a prime or a number with two prime factors. You could never basically determine the parity, whether there's an even number of prime factors and odd numbers. So that was called the parity barrier. It still exists today. But you can sort of avoid the parity barrier by not asking, pick a set of k numbers, and we're just going to try to show that there's a couple of them that are prime. But we won't tell you which ones. So if you just ask the question, can I find two primes among those, say, 100 numbers that are prime, but I'm not going to know which of the two are prime, you can avoid the parity barrier. So you sort of add some uncertainty into it, and you're no longer blocked. So basically, the GPY method is to try to find sure that there's two primes or more primes among a large number of numbers here. If you're going to do it for, we traditionally do it with tuples, but you could do the same thing by multiplying the numbers together and saying, does this number have less than 2k minus 1 primes among those k numbers? So in other words, if there's less than or equal to 2k minus 2 primes in these k numbers, all together, then there has to be two of them that have a single prime, just by the pigeonhole principle. So here's how GPY method works. You introduce this weight that comes out of sort of a variety of things. This is the Mobius function. The divisor sum that's truncated. And we expect that this weight is going to be small, except when these guys only have a few prime factors. And the reason that's the case, you see, is that V is going to be truncated less than R. If all of these guys are primes, for example, N is going to be much larger than R. It's going to be like R squared or R to the fourth. Then the only divisors less than R that will divide this will be 1. You only have a single term in this sum, you see. And therefore, it will be large. It will be like log of R to the K plus L. So basically, when you have primes, this will be large, and by SIP methods, because of the Mobius function, this has a lot of prime factors, hopefully it'll be small. So to sort of detect when you don't have many prime factors. And then what you do is you look at that weight and you square it and look at its average size. And then you also look at this weight where you take one of the components and you freeze it and require it to be a prime. So this is sort of the key to the method, is that you look at both the average of the sequence and the average of the sequence when you freeze one of the components to be prime. And when you try to actually evaluate this sum, it turns out when you square this out, you have to have n go through an arithmetic progression of primes, and you have to look at the number of primes in an arithmetic progression, mod the product of the divisors that come in. And that's where the primes and arithmetic progressions comes in. Anyhow, you go through this procedure, and you try to show that this sum, if you have k prime, if you're looking at a tuple size k, if you can show that this sum is bigger than 1 over k times the average, then that would imply that there has to be, when you add them up, there have to be times when this guy overlaps. Not all of these primes in each of these individual components can be separate from other ones, or else you'd have a sum here where this thing's always less than equal to 1, and it would be smaller than the prime. And that's how the GPY method works. And it turns out it fails. So this method didn't quite work. It almost worked, but it just didn't quite. It got you within epsilon. So what you ended up proving by GPY was not bounded gaps, but that you could get gaps that were smaller than the average. On the other hand, if you conjectured a better distribution of primes in the arithmetic progression, it works fine, and you can actually do it with k equals 7. So if you assume a conjecture on primes in the arithmetic progressions, you would find that there are infinitely often primes differing by 20. That's a tough conjecture. So just to repeat it again, because I happen to have this transparency, here's the kind of weight we're using. And of course, the trick is to be able to evaluate these kind of sums. Or you can generalize it to polynomials if you want to refine things a bit. And then what you do is you look at the primes on each of the components and add it up over the components minus the number m. And then you look at this weighted sum here. And the idea here is that if you can show that this whole sum is positive, because this is squared, that means that something in here has to be positive. So if you took m to be 1, this sum, each one of these terms has a value of 1 if n plus hi is a prime, and 0 otherwise. So if this thing's positive, these guys are 1s, and you're subtracting 1, the only way it can be positive is sometimes there's two terms in this sum. That gives you 2 n plus hi and n plus hj that are both prime at the same time. So that's how the method works. You can do the same thing for m primes, if you can find good enough weights. And that's the GPY method. Now, that's the easy part of the GPY method. The hard part is you have to actually work out the asymptotic formula. So, as usual, when you get down to it, you have to do this grungy work that's sort of fun, but only if you like spending a lot of time on it. So there's the grungy part. So what was needed for the breakthrough in 2013-14 beyond GPY? And actually, I was thinking about this. When we worked on GPY, it looked like it was almost optimal. We felt that the method itself was only losing a teeny bit, because we could prove that given the method, you couldn't possibly make that number turn positive and get bounded gaps. So we thought our choice of weights was optimal. And we also thought this 1/2 barrier for the primes and arithmetic progressions was also something that was really hard to break. So we thought that we sort of got fooled because we thought we were smarter than we really were, I guess. And, I mean, but, you know, people always are, you see patterns, things, you know, when you come up exactly with the best that's known, a half, and just lose by a little, you tend to think, well, that's natural. I saw this article in Science Magazine where they were trying to figure out why some bees are smarter than other bees from the same hive. And it turned out, they figured out the smart bees were the ones that recognized patterns. So in the lab, the smart bees would always go to the same color of fake flower to get their pollen. Then they put them out in the field. It turned out the smart bees weren't any better than the dumb bees at actually getting pollen, because they sort of incorrectly picked out certain colors of flowers to go to. The dumb ones didn't care, but of course flowers were a little more variable than. So we often get fooled because we see patterns that aren't really there until it turns out we find out we were wrong. The other thing about bounded gaps between primes, which is that a lot of us thought it was so hard, because a lot of smart people have told us it was hard, that we never actually worked on it, so we just gave up. And that was certainly true in what Zhang did, which was that the experts who should have been able to figure it out didn't figure it out, so everyone else figured, well, they're a lot smarter than we are. Why should we spend 5 years and fail to do what they can do in 2 weeks? Zhang didn't have that prejudice. So that was the psychological barriers, but what were the mathematical barriers that had to be broken? And in Zhang's case, the reason people hadn't done it before is you had to take two ideas and put them together. And each one individually had actually been pretty much done, but no one had tried to put them together. And Zhang said that basically what he'd do is he'd work on one side for a while, then he'd switch and work on the other side for a while. He was sort of switching back and forth. He was always thinking of solving the problem rather than taking one half of the problem as the way it was and only working on the other half. So it sort of paid off for him. What he found was that you could, in that GPY method, you could, instead of taking all the divisors, you could just restrict it to divisors without large prime. You could avoid them with large prime divisors than the divisors in that sum, which makes the method less good. But then the divisors you have a lot of prime factors. And then on the other hand, you could then improve the distribution of primes in arithmetic progressions when the progressions were numbers that had a large number of prime factors. So basically he weakened one side to be able to prove a new result on the other side for the arithmetic progressions, get a level of distribution bigger than half. And for the second method, Maynard and Tao, they basically chose what you would call multi-dimensional Selberg weights, which is that rather than looking at the product of all these numbers in the divisors, you take each one individually and put in a divisor, and then you try to optimize over all possible weights where you include each divisor individually so it can be affected individually, whereas in GPY, we basically had a single divisor that multiplied the product. Now, I can't say that that is a new idea. In fact, Selberg suggested doing exactly the same thing back in 1951 for a different problem. And I tried to do it too, but the difference was that in Maynard's case, he just really knew how to do these things really. It's very hard, unless you were told that this was going to work, to believe it would actually work. But when you do it right, everything actually works really nicely. And probably in 5 years, you'll see it in some textbook. Where you actually obtain these, it'll be a textbook on the Selberg sieve, and in that chapter they'll obtain these multi-dimensional weights and get this result. Now I wanted to conclude with something. I was going to tell you a whole bunch about all the crackpots I have to deal with all the time. And I have their emails, and there's one guy who sends out emails every day saying Goldstein's wrong, Zhang is wrong, everybody's wrong, and but you don't want to hear about that. Just to make sure, I put him in my spam folder, so I hadn't seen too much of him, but he's been somehow penetrating back into my email. I wanted to find out if he was still alive, so like earlier this, I guess last week, I sent him an email and I said, "You are a pig." And then I started getting all these emails from him saying, "Goldstein's wrong, Goldstein's 100% wrong, Goldstein isn't even wrong. He's so wrong, he's not even wrong," which sounded like a physics insult, and I checked, and sure enough, he does physics, too. He's also proved the Riemann hypothesis by proving the zeta function has no complex zeros, which news to everyone else. Anyhow, here's what a lot of amateurs get messed up on, which is the sieve of Eratosthenes, which is a natural place to start. So maybe I won't bore you. So you start with all the numbers, and then you remove all the multiples of 2, except 2 itself. Then you remove the multiples of 3, and then you remove the multiples of 5. And you see, by removing the multiples up to 5, the next number I'm going to get in this list that isn't a prime is really going to be 7 squared, right? Because that's everything below that has to have a prime factor of 5 or below. So basically, you generate the primes by looking up to the square root of number. So that's a good procedure for finding primes, but it's a bad way to prove anything about primes. So the natural way to actually try to use this is to see what's left after you've sieved for a while. So of course, if you start with, I'm sieving up to x, you start with the 4 of x numbers, you remove half of them from the even, then you remove a third of them from the multiples of 3, but now you've removed the multiples of 6 twice, you know, both the 2 and 3, so you have to return them again. So you do this inclusion-exclusion, which is basically, in terms of proportions, just multiplying 1 minus a half times 1 minus a third, and so on. And this is just a little bit of math. Here's how we do it with equations. We use this identity for the Möbius function is 1 if D has an even number of prime factors, and it's odd, it's minus 1 if it has an odd number, but mu of a prime is minus 1. And it's 0 if you ever have a square factor. And this is a basic element, I mean, most of you have probably seen this. This is a basic property of the Möbius function. You sum it over all the divisors, and then you get 1 if n is 1, and 0 otherwise. So this is pretty useful, because if you wanted to figure out if it's 6, say you wanted to figure out if 6 is equal to 1 or not, you would look at its divisors, 1, 2, 3, well. So that, I know that sounds stupid. That was a joke, actually. But the reason this relation is useful is because we're not going to just test whether one number is 1 or not. We're going to test a whole bunch of numbers. So here's how you apply it. If you think about the sieve of Eratosthenes, you look at the numbers up to x, and we remove all the numbers except numbers that have no common factor with the primes up to square root of x. So you let p be the product of the primes up to y. This will be the product of the primes up to x. When you put parentheses here, it means the GCD. So we're going to count the numbers that are relatively prime to all the primes up to square root of x. So what you're left with is the primes between x and square root of x and the number 1 itself. So that's how we would try to get at the number of primes by sieving. So when I try to figure this thing out here, I detect this condition by simply looking at the divisors of the GCD of these two things. You will see this thing will be 0 unless this guy is 1. But if D divides the GCD, it's equivalent to having D divide each of the two numbers. So therefore, you can break the sum up into two pieces and bring the sum over the divisors of P of square root primes up the square root of x out, and then you're just summing over the number of divisors, the multiples of D up to x. The number of multiples of D up to x is the floor of x over P. And now we make a mistake, but it's such a small mistake that you wouldn't think it would really matter, which is the floor isn't a continuous function. So what if I just remove the floor and just take it to be x over d plus this is the fractional part of x over d? So this is a number that's some number between 0 and 1, whereas x over d, if d is small, is a huge number. So I'm only making an error of at most 1 in each term when I do this. Well, this is a sum of multiplicative function. It's easy to see it's the product of the primes of the square root of x of 1 minus 1 over p. And here's this error. And here's what we think. Möbius function is plus or minus 1 depending on whether d has an even or an odd number of prime factors. So it's very, very random. In fact, you add it up, you believe you get square root cancellation, and that's equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis. Fractional parts like this should be completely uniformly distributed between 0 and 1. So you have totally random, totally evenly distributed. So you would think this thing is just noise and will cancel out. But unfortunately, it doesn't turn out that way. It turns out that by Mervyn's formula, which is easier than prime number theorem, this thing's basically asymptotic to e to the minus gamma x this number divided by log of this number. So this factor here is actually asymptotic to e to e to the minus gamma x over log x. So if you plug that in, what you get is the number of primes minus a very a number that's like square root of x in size is exactly this minus this error term. But if you remember at the beginning of the talk, the prime number theorem says that you get x over log of x. So this guy should be 1, but it's actually about 1.12. So what that proves is that when you ignore all those little errors in the severe opacities, they don't cancel out. In fact, you get the wrong answer. So this is what I deal with all the time. People always use the sieve of Eratosthenes to prove to a prime projection. But the sieve of Eratosthenes absolutely fails to prove the prime number theorem. So how can you prove a set that's much smaller than primes using a method that doesn't even detect the primes correctly? About 10% of the primes is, whoops, is in here. Okay, and here's my last transparency, I think. There is a way around this problem, which is what we call modern sieve methods. And what it is you give up on the idea of getting asymptotic formulas from a sieve and just try to get upper and lower bounds that are pretty good. So the problem is that the number of divisors of the product of the primes up to square root of x is a huge number. Because the product of the primes up to square root of x is like e to the square root of x, essentially. So there's an exponential number of divisors that you're looking at, and they completely swamp the main term. The only way to avoid that is to actually not sieve very far, but then you don't actually get primes in the main term either. So the solution is what's called sieve method, invented by Broom initially, which is instead of, this is the guy that's 0 or 1, instead of using it, try to use something similar where these weights will make this thing always bigger than this, and these weights will always make it less than this. Then you go through exactly the same analysis I did before, but instead of having the Mobius function in the main term, you have these factors. And then typically these won't give you an asymptotic formula, but maybe they'll give you an upper bound that's pretty close to the asymptotic. And these guys will be determined so that they don't have that many divisors among them. So you can handle the error. Anyhow, Broom did this, and he actually just chose these guys to either be mu of b or 0, depending on if they have k distinct prime factors or not. So he handled the number of prime factors by just limiting it. Turned out if r was odd, it was an upper bound, I think. If it was even, it was a lower bound, or vice versa. But it was pretty complicated. And Selberg had a really brilliant idea for obtaining an upper bound. It's only brilliant, it's stupid, in a way it's stupid actually. It's brilliant because it works so amazingly well. This is what makes all that new stuff we did on gaps between primes, the new stuff in 2013, 2014, completely Selberg sieve all the way through. It's completely elementary. And so here's his idea. You want to upper bound this thing. So what you do is you take a divisor sum like this and you square it, and the numbers you put in here are totally arbitrary except for when 1, lambda 1 we choose to be 1. And this inequality is completely trivial because, see, this guy here is either, it's 1 if n is 1. So you see, if n is 1 here, the only divisor is 1, so this is just lambda 1, which we chose to be 1, so you get equality. And then if n isn't 1, this guy is 0, but this guy is greater than or equal to 0 because you squared it. And if you multiply this thing out, you get exactly a sum like this. So this is trivially an upper bound. The lambdas are totally at your disposal. And then you can try to optimize it because you get a quadratic form. And you can control the number of divisors because you simply choose this guy to be 0 as soon as b is bigger than some cutoff. So you try to make the cutoff as big as possible for flexibility, but you keep it small enough to keep the error terms small. And this is basically amazingly well, it's amazing how it works so well. You have to do some work on the optimization, of course, but it's basically a simple elementary idea. I mean, it's what generated all this stuff. So anyhow, I'll quit.